Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. In this podcast, two experts give their insights on the recommended workup for a timely and accurate diagnosis, as well as the evolving treatment landscape and importance of individualizing therapy for patients with cold agglutinin disease. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In our first interview, Dr. Catherine Broom considers when to suspect cold agglutinin disease and the workup needed to confirm a diagnosis, the impact of poor sample handling and delays to diagnosis, as well as the importance of real-world data in informing ongoing management of patients with cold agglutinin disease.
Hi, I'm Dr. Catherine Broom from MedStar Georgetown University Hospital, Associate Professor of Medicine at Lombardi Cancer Center.
What signs and symptoms should increase your clinical suspicion of cold agglutinin disease?
So cold agglutinin disease is oftentimes very difficult to diagnose. We need to really be detectives as we put together some of these very non-specific signs and symptoms that may clue us in to the concept that our patient does have cold agglutinin disease. And remember that it's incredibly important to make this diagnosis because different forms of autoimmune hemolytic anemia have different therapeutic interventions. So our patients are generally going to come to us with a constellation of very non-specific symptoms: anemia, dyspnea on exertion or shortness of breath, fatigue. They may be experiencing some tachycardia or palpitations. Now, some that are more specific with regards to cold agglutinin disease include cold-triggered symptoms, which are going to happen in up to 90% of patients. These may be very mild acrocyanotic symptoms. They could be Raynaud's phenomenon. They could be libido reticularis. They could be as severe as gangrene or necrotic digits. So we really want to question our patients very carefully about any cold-induced symptoms, which is then going to give us the indication that we may want to do a further workup for the presence of cold agglutinins and possibly cold agglutinin disease.
What tests and in what order are recommended to diagnose primary cold agglutinin disease?
So back to our detective work, we've now suspected that our patient may have cold agglutinin disease. What do we want to confirm? I think the easiest place to begin is to confirm that the patient is having hemolysis. So we want to look at hemolytic markers like LDH, which should be elevated, bilirubin, which in all likelihood will also be elevated, a haptoglobin, which is going to be decreased, and then if the patient has normal bone marrow function, they should have a reticulocytosis indicating their compensation for hemolysis. If those things aren't true, then we're probably not dealing with a hemolytic anemia and we need to reconsider our diagnosis. But if those things are true and we have a hemolytic anemia, the next thing we want to figure out is this an autoimmune-based hemolytic anemia or is it some other form of hemolytic anemia? And in order to do that, we want to order a direct antiglobulin test. If this is an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, the polyspecific direct antiglobulin test should be positive. We can then move on to look at the monospecific portion of the direct antiglobulin test, which in cold agglutinin disease should be positive for C3d. If it is positive for IgG, then that is more indicative of warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia. If it is positive for C3d and only weakly positive for IgG, that is more indicative of cold agglutinin disease. Once we've established that this is an autoimmune hemolytic anemia that is positive for C3d, we're going to then perform a cold agglutinin titer. If the cold agglutinin titer is greater than 1 to 64, then we are dealing with either cold agglutinin disease or cold agglutinin syndrome, which is cold-mediated hemolysis secondary to another cause. So then We're looking at, do we have an underlying condition that may be triggering the formation of this autoantibody? If the answer is yes, we've got infection, we've got an underlying malignancy, a lymphoproliferative disorder, then we have cold agglutinin syndrome. If the answer is no, we haven't found any underlying disease, then we are considering cold agglutinin disease, and we should do a bone marrow to look for this monoclonal population of B cells and a serum electrophoresis looking for the potential of a monoclonal IgM. Once we have all of that information, we are now very secure in our diagnosis of cold agglutinin disease, and we can move on to discussing with our patient their new diagnosis and what are their therapeutic options.
How important is timing of tests and proper sample handling in obtaining accurate results?
As we just mentioned, with regards to timing of results and looking at the samples, the proper handling is really incredibly important. These titers, or the presence of these antibodies, can be in very low amounts. And so proper handling of these specimens is critical. It requires a lot of communication and collaboration between the physician ordering the test, the laboratory team, the phlebotomist, the nurses. Incorrect sample handling can result in a false negative result with regards to cold agglutinin titers. And so then you may be confused about what you're dealing with from the standpoint of a diagnosis. So some tips for handling the sample, right? You want to pre-warm the vacuum tubes before you draw the blood. You want to maintain that specimen at core body temperature while it's being transported to the laboratory. You want to make sure that the laboratory knows that they also need to maintain that sample at core body temperature until they are prepared to run the testing. And this testing can include trying to assay something as simple as the hemoglobin level, all the way to the complexity of doing cold agglutinin titers, as we previously discussed. So it's not a laboratory order that you can hand the patient a piece of paper and expect that they can go to any drawing station or any laboratory and expect that you're going to get reliable results. This really does require a team effort and good communication and appropriate coordination between all of the aspects of getting the sample collected, transported, and subsequently evaluated under these warm conditions.
How do diagnostic delays impact treatment decisions and outcomes?
So unfortunately, I think that treatment delays are not uncommon. As I mentioned previously, this is a disease that presents with some very non-specific symptoms. And so garnering a diagnosis can oftentimes take many months. So this is a 69-year-old female who presented with some shortness of breath in 2011. She saw her primary care provider multiple times over several months and received no diagnosis. A variety of tests were performed, but she was not given any explanation as to the etiology of her shortness of breath. Finally, after several months, the primary care physician noted that the patient was in fact anemic and did then refer the patient to a hematologist. So almost a whole year has passed. She finally is in the hematologist's office in February of 2012. She's noted to be anemic. She's noted to have a DAT, which is positive, or a Coombs positive for hemolytic anemia. She has a positive cold agglutinin titer. And she then begins a therapeutic journey that is not uncommon for our cold agglutinin disease patients either. Her journey consisted of rituximab and steroids. She was on steroids for many months, had a partial response, but remained on steroids for almost a whole year. was finally weaned off of those steroids, and then very quickly had worsening of her symptoms again, her fatigue, her shortness of breath, and evidence of recurrent hemolysis. As is often the case, the patient was again treated with the same therapy that she had before, was on steroids again for another prolonged period of time, had another relapse with hemolysis, shortness of breath, and fatigue. She finally got a little bit of a breather from her disease between late 2014 and 2016, but then again had another relapse. And again, sort of went back to that same well of therapy that she had had before. She then presented to hospital with very severe symptoms, very severe anemia, shortness of breath. She had developed necrotic lesions on her ear and her thumb, and she had suffered a pulmonary embolus. Her therapeutic intervention was sort of increased related to this very severe presentation. She was begun on plasma exchange, and then she was also begun on an effort to try to suppress the production of these IgM autoantibodies with cyclophosphamide. In spite of this, she only obtained a partial response, had persistent fatigue, and really only maintained her hemoglobin at around 9. So, you know, this is a journey that's not unfamiliar to patients who have cold agglutinin disease. They oftentimes don't get a diagnosis for many, many months. Once they do get a diagnosis, they're oftentimes sort of partially treated, and steroids are a therapy that really is not very effective for cold agglutinin disease, and one that we should think about avoiding in this particular patient population.
Will longitudinal real-world data help to inform our understanding of the natural history of cold agglutinin disease?
So, you know, this is a rare disorder, and up until very recently, we did not have very large cohorts of patients where we could evaluate what is the impact of this disease on coexisting conditions, what is the impact of this disease on survival, are there any hidden risks that these patients may experience. So in a cohort comparison study, which was a retrospective evaluation of cold agglutinin disease patients over a 10-year period, what we were able to notice is that patients with cold agglutinin disease have a 29.6% rate of experiencing thromboembolic events. When you compare that to an age and sex-matched control population, which was also matched for other coexisting conditions, those patients only had a 17.6% rate of developing thromboembolic events. So our patients with cold agglutinin disease have a 1.9 times higher risk of developing a thromboembolic event. I think it's important to recognize this risk. And just like in the patient that I presented, when they present with worsening shortness of breath, we have to be careful not to attribute this only to their anemia, but to think about evaluating them for underlying thromboembolic events as a co-etiology for some of the symptoms that they may have. When we look at these patients in a large U.S. database, and again, another retrospective analysis, 72% of these patients had one or more severe anemia events within their first year of follow-up. I think both of these pieces of information go a long way to inform us to the fact that cold agglutinin disease is really not a very benign disorder. It's not a disorder that we can say, oh, you have it, you don't really need medical follow-up, you're going to be fine. I think we need to be really cognizant of the fact that this can present real issues for our patients. Now, both of these are retrospective studies. What we're hoping for in the future through our CADENCE registry, which is collecting real-world data on cold agglutinin disease patients, is that we will be able to prospectively evaluate data, including comorbidities, treatments, and disease characteristics. We're hoping that all of this information will continue to educate and enlighten us, which will then allow us to continue to move forward and improve treatments for our patients with cold agglutinin disease.
Thank you for those interesting insights, Dr. Broom. Now let's move on to our next interview with Dr. Eileen Weitz, who will outline the role of complement inhibitors as an alternative treatment option in the evolving treatment landscape of CAD and how to use specific markers to tailor treatment for individual patients.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Eileen Weitz, and I'm a professor of medicine at the Jane Ann Knoll Division of Hematology, Keck USC School of Medicine in Los Angeles, California.
How are complement inhibitors changing the current treatment paradigm for cold agglutinin disease?
Complement inhibitors have been used in many diseases now, but in particular, complement targeting in cold agglutinin disease has been successful. We know that with cold agglutinin disease, because this is antibody mediated with an IgM antibody that binds at cold temperatures and then fixes complement, that the induction of hemolysis is dependent on the antigen antibody complement complex. Once you activate complement and you generate C3b on the cells, that C3b gets cleared by the splenic macrophage and the liver macrophages, which then cause extravascular hemolysis. Unlike some other disorders, which are driven primarily by the MAC complex or the terminal complement complex, cold agglutinin disease is really driven by extravascular hemolysis due to complement deposition and C3b deposition on the cells. There are two complement inhibitors that have been used in cold agglutinin disease, including eculizumab, which is not approved for that indication, but there is a phase 2 trial, the DECADE trial, which does indicate that it blocks terminal complement activation. However, C1s inhibition using sutimlimab has been approved based on the results of the CARDINAL phase 3 trial, and recently the CADENZA phase 3 trial, which looks at patients who have not had a heavy transfusion history, was just published in Blood this week. There are some additional therapies that are being looked at, including the C3 inhibitor pegcetacoplan, which blocks the generation of C3b, iptacopan, which is a factor B inhibitor, which blocks the alternative pathway of complement, and BIVV020, which is a next-generation sutimlimab, which blocks C1s activated.
In terms of the evolving treatment landscape for cold agglutinin disease, when should clinicians consider the use of rituximab or sutimlimab?
There are several issues to consider in patients who have cold-mediated autoimmune hemolytic anemia or cold agglutinin disease. For patients who are asymptomatic, they have no minimal evidence of hemolysis, you can just watch them. This is a disease that is somewhat variable in terms of its presentation. You're more likely to see these patients in the winter. It was 104 in Los Angeles yesterday, and the patients are not going to present with raging hemolysis with that kind of weather. However, when the patients go into air conditioning, they will become symptomatic. If the patient is symptomatic, then you need to look at what treatments are available. All cold agglutinin disease patients have a low-grade lymphoproliferative process. However, it's not overt lymphoma or leukemia. And so one could look at chemotherapy or rituximab in that setting. However, there are risks to those treatments, and particularly in the era of COVID, where you suppress antibody production, that makes it very risky for the patients. There's an increased risk of infection. You could, if the patient is very symptomatic, You could use plasmapheresis to remove the IgM, or you could and or consider using a C5 inhibitor such as eculizumab to block terminal complement. However, it makes much more sense to use a C1s inhibitor, which works earlier in the complement cascade and blocks the deposition of C3b and then the subsequent macrophage clearing of these coated red C3b coated red cells. If the patient has no response to rituximab, you could use rituximab plus bendamustine or bortezomib or fludarabine, but there's a much higher risk of infectious complications with that combination. It also takes about 6 weeks before you see a response with rituximab and bendamustine or chemotherapy, other chemotherapy. In contrast to that, the data from the Cardinal study and the Cadenza study using sutimlimab show response within the first week with decreased hemolysis and increased hemoglobin.
Are there any biomarkers or other factors to help tailor treatment to the individual patient?
Primary CAD is characterized by chronic hemolysis with the absence of overt lymphoma or lymphoproliferative disorder. A monospecific Coombs test or direct antiglobulin test is usually strongly positive for C3, B, and D, and negative for IgG. These are usually IgM proteins, and a cold agglutinin titer of greater than 1 to 64 is useful in making the diagnosis. The IgM can be identified by serum protein electrophoresis and immunoelectrophoresis, and most often is IgM kappa. There are markers of hemolysis that are useful in identifying the hemolysis, and that includes the bilirubin, the LDH, the haptoglobin, and the reticulocyte count. And those can be useful biomarkers that can be followed with treatment of the underlying disease.
What indicators can be used to measure treatment response, and how can we measure the impact of cold agglutinin disease from a patient perspective?
The best indicators for measuring treatment response are to look at the hemolysis. So, number one, you want to see that the markers of hemolysis have decreased. So the bilirubin goes down, the LDH goes down, the hemoglobin comes up, and the reticulocyte count goes down. Second, you want to look at the fatigue, which may improve with correction of the anemia, but is also dependent on cytokines from complement activation. And these complement-driven cytokines decrease with treatment. You want to see improvement in laboratory parameters, such as an increase in the hemoglobin and a decrease in the bilirubin, especially the indirect bilirubin, and a decrease in the LDH. And you want to see improvement in the quality of life. The one thing that does not improve with sutimlimab is the circulatory symptoms, the Raynaud's phenomena, for example, which may persist even though all of the other parameters improve. Other things to look at in terms of treatment efficacy include normalization of the hemoglobin, so the absence of anemia, signs of hemolysis decrease, clinical symptoms overall improve. The serum protein will not change per se unless there's chemotherapy given concurrently. A partial response may be evidenced by an improvement but not normalization of the hemoglobin, symptom improvement, and a reduction in transfusion dependence. The IgM level, again, won't change as a result of sutimlimab therapy, but may improve with chemotherapy or rituximab type treatment. Assessing the patient experience, patient reported outcomes may help clinicians make effective treatment decisions. And there's no question that cold agglutinin disease regularly causes fatigue. It impacts the symptomatology of the patient. And these patients tend to be older and may have many comorbidities. So it may have impacts on that. Patient-reported outcomes offer insights into the patient's perception of their disease. And some of those patient-reported outcomes include the FACIT fatigue score, the SF-12, EQ-5D-5L, and the PGIC.
Thank you, Dr. Weitz, for sharing your insights on the evolving treatment options for patients with cold agglutinin disease. Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access additional content on this and related topics on touchoncology.com.